morning.
Good morning.
You know, I think everyone from time to time feels like their life is a little bit like the roll of the dice. Like it's just fate, that you have no control over it. Like you're just rolling the dice and you're just hoping for the best. To kind of illustrate that this morning, I've asked for a volunteer to come up here and help me. And so David Everett has agreed to that. So David, come on up here. He has no idea what he's volunteering for. David and I, just about a month ago, returned from a mission trip, and David and his wife, Sandia, and I were all, we were kind of a team down there. We worked on several different projects together, and I hope you'll still be my friend when we get done this morning. All right, here's what we're going to do, David. Here in just a moment, we're going to roll these dice. I'm going to roll them, not you, okay? I'm going to roll the dice, and if we come up with snake eyes, deuces, or boxcars. I learned that Las Vegas lingo. I had to ask Eddie what all that stuff meant. He told me so. Now I know what it is. But we're going to roll. If we roll any of those three combinations, then I have a gift card for you. So it's a gift card. You'll like it. But if we don't roll any of those combinations, then I have this chocolate cream pie, but it's not like you get to eat it with a fork. It's more this way. Right, exactly. And I have a nice towel here so we can clean you up afterwards. So, are you ready? So you know what we're looking for? Snake eyes, deuces, boxcars. All right, here we go. Oh, I'm sorry. 5 and a 4. I'm sorry, David. You'll still be my friend, right? Okay, good. You're a good sport. He doesn't have any guns at home, does he? All right. I need you to hold out your hands. I'll let you do it because that won't hurt you. Oh, I got to take the top. All right. You got to close your eyes because we don't want you to get pie in your face and in your eyeballs and all that kind of thing. Pretty good. I want you to be my friend, plus I didn't want to mess up the stage. Let's give him a hand. You know, when these kind of things happen in life, you know, the 5 and the 4, which obviously wasn't one of the things that we wanted, you know, sometimes people will say, well, that was just lucky, or he was unlucky in this kind of case if I would have put the pie in his face. And, you know, on a much bigger scale, things that happen in our lives, you know, circumstances and stuff like that, there's kind of 3 different ways I think people kind of look at that kind of stuff. One is what I just said, well, I was just lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. And then, you know, along with that is unlucky. It just wasn't my day. It just wasn't. And then there's like, well, it's just coincidence. It was just fate. That's just the way it happened. And then there's another point of view, which some of you adhere to and that I adhere to, is that God's in control of everything. And there is no such thing as coincidence or luck. God is orchestrating everything. And if you believe that like I do, you are going to connect with the character that we're looking at today, Esther. Because she knew what it was like to go big or go home. So we're continuing our series called The Story, where we started in Genesis and we're going to go all the way through Revelation this year, just kind of hitting the high spots. And of course, about a year and a half ago, before we had this series planned, I spent 10 weeks in Esther. Well, this morning, you're going to kind of get the Cliff Notes version, obviously. And we're just going to kind of go through it and look at the book of Esther. Now, our story starts in the Persian Empire, not in the Babylonian Empire, and it doesn't start in Las Vegas, obviously. It starts in Susa. And we've got a little map up there so you can kind of get an idea of where things are. The red arrow is Susa. I'm sorry, the white arrow is Susa. The red arrow is Babylon. And Babylon, you may remember, was the nation that first came under King Nebuchadnezzar and captured the nation of Israel and Judah and drug them away. And you can see Jerusalem there. It's represented by the yellow arrow. And so it just kind of gives you an idea of where everything is. And to kind of help you remember our five characters this morning, I want to use playing cards. And I think also this would help you if you want to tell the story to somebody else. And there's just really five characters today. First of all, we have a king. And he is the king of diamonds, and we'll call him King Xerxes. And then he had a queen, and her name was Queen Vashti. And so she's the queen of diamonds. And then we have the new queen, who is Queen Esther. And then we have the Joker. And his name is Haman. And we don't call him the Joker because he jokes and is funny. But he's a joker in the sense that he's just this hateful, despicable guy. And then we have our ace in the hole, the ace of hearts. And his name is Mordecai. And Mordecai's the guy who kind of comes on the scene and comes to the rescue, so to speak. So those are our main characters this morning, those five. And so as we begin our story, you may remember last week, and you saw that map a while ago. Can anybody remember how many people we talked about last week in the book of Ezra left Persia to go rebuild to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple? Anybody want to take a stab how many people it was? You're close? A little lower? 50,000. Thank you very much. I should give you the five, but thank you. Actually, I have another. Okay. But 50,000 people. So that wasn't everybody. So today's story is about those that stayed behind. So we get into chapter 1 of Esther, and the first thing we read is King Xerxes is throwing a party. Now, this isn't your 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. birthday bash. This is like the mother of all parties. It's 180 days of eating and drinking all you want. 180 days this party goes on. At the end of the 180 days, apparently that wasn't long enough, even though it's been a half a year, the king decides to extend it one more week. So they're going to have another week of partying. And that's where we're going to pick up the story in Esther chapter 1, verse 10. Follow along on your Bibles, or you can follow along the scriptures on the screen. So here's what it says in chapter 1, verse 10. On the seventh day. Now this isn't that additional week, so really it's the 187th day. When King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine. You think after 187 days of drinking that he might be a little bit drunk? It's like the understatement of the century. So he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown. Now, when Queen Vashti reacts to this, you're like, well, what's the big deal about him asking her to come in and wear her crown? Almost all scholars think it wasn't that simple. He was asking her to come in wearing her crown without any clothes on. He wanted to parade her in front of all these men nude. And we go on and we read what else it says here. It makes sense this way because she refused to do it. In order to display her beauty to the peoples and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Queen Vashti, she had character. She wasn't going to do this. She wasn't going to be paraded before a bunch of drunken men. So she refused to do it. Now the men of the kingdom, his advisors and things like this, they say, King Xerxes, this is a problem. You see, if word gets out that your queen's not doing what you told her to do and is disrespectful, then all the ladies in the kingdom aren't going to do what we tell them to do. And that's going to be a big, big issue. You've got to do something about this king. So you know what the king does? Gone with Vashti. She's history. we never hear about Queen Vashti again. 4 years pass. 4 years, and the king does not have a queen. And finally, he decides that he wants a new queen. And so the process needs to start. How do we get the king a new queen? He's despondent. He's depressed. He's lost several significant military battles. And having a harem is not the same thing as having a wife. So his advisors come to him again. And they say, we have an idea, king. Why don't we have a beauty pageant? And we'll bring in the prettiest girls in the whole kingdom. And then you pick the prettiest one. Now, does that not sound like a plan a bunch of men would come up with? Right? And I'm sure it doesn't say this in scriptures, but I bet a bunch of them volunteered to be the judges, right? So that's the plan that they come up with. I want you to look at Esther chapter 2, verse 7, before we talk any more about the beauty pageant. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her on as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So Mordecai has taken his younger cousin, who is an orphan, and he's raising her. And she's very beautiful. And somehow, somebody who knows what's going on, some official or something, sees her and knows of her beauty and puts her in to this beauty pageant. But before the beauty pageant takes place, they're going to take these young ladies, and there's probably thousands of them, and they're going to basically have a beauty school. And it lasts an entire year. Guys, you think your wife takes a long time to get ready? I mean, a solid year. And then there's my twisted mind part of this. If it takes you a year to get beautiful, you don't have much hope, right? But it says that she's lovely and that she's beautiful. So she gets in this beauty school, and there's oil of myrrh facials, and there's healthy meals, and there's Pilates, and there's yoga, and all the cosmetics and perfumes that you need, and classes in seduction, and all these kind of things, all designed so that you can win and be the top queen of Persia. So she goes through this process. Verse 10. This is very important. Esther had not revealed to anyone her nationality, nor her family background, because Mordecai had forbidden her from doing that. So nobody knows that Esther is a Jew. That is still a secret. So she goes through these 12 months, and the day finally comes, and these ladies are competing, and when Esther shows up, it's game over. I mean, it's over. For the other thousands of contestants, they can go home. Esther and the king get married, and it's declared a national holiday. It's like a Cinderella story, My Fair Lady, Pretty Woman. I mean, it's just this crazy, unbelievable story. And then at the end of chapter 2, there's this like story that's just kind of tacked on after the beauty pageant and stuff. And it just seems kind of insignificant. I mean, you read that little story at the end of chapter 2 and you think, why is that there? And this is what it is. I'm paraphrasing. There are a couple of palace guards who decide that they're going to throw a coup, and they're going to overthrow the king. And so they're hatching this plan, and Mordecai hears about it. They plan to assassinate the king. Mordecai gets wind of this. And so he tells the right people, who then go to these two guys, they arrest them, and they execute them. And they execute them by impaling them. This is what that means. They take a pole, and they run it up a person's body this way, and then they hang them like that until they die. Not around their neck, but they're hanging on that pole until they die. The ancient people sometimes could come up with the most barbaric ways of punishing and killing people. In this particular case, they wanted them to be an example to everybody else. You don't mess with the king. And so it tells us at the end of the story that is written down that Mordecai did this, but he's never recognized for it. He's never given a medal or officially honored for it. It's just kind of written down. And it seems insignificant, but when we get to this later, you'll find out that that little insignificant tidbit is really significant in the book of Esther. So we go into chapter 3, and the king needs an administrative assistant, and it's Haman, our joker. And he makes Haman his administrative assistant, and he probably doesn't realize that Haman absolutely despises Jews. He hates them. He wants to exterminate the entire race of Jews. He is a descendant of King Agag, who was an Amalekite. And so he is an Amalekite. And here's why this is significant. That particular group of people were the first group of people that the nation of Israel had to get out of their way to take the land of Canaan. And you may remember, God told Saul, I don't want you to leave a man, woman, or child alive. And Saul disobeyed, and he left some of them alive. And now, years later, it's coming back to haunt them. Because Haman has a chip on his shoulder. And he has an axe to grind. He hates these people. And he's kind of past this thing that everybody he walks by needs to bow down before him. He's got a big ego. He's a power-hungry kind of person. Guess who won't bow down? Mordecai. That just infuriates Haman. So he wants to get Mordecai killed. He wants to have this entire race exterminated. So we read down in chapter 3, verse 6. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, in other words, that they were Jewish, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. You know what Haman was? He was a Hitler. He was a bona fide racist. And he wants to kill not just Mordecai, he wants to kill all of them. So here's his plan. He comes up with this plan, and he brings it to the king. And he says, King, these Jewish people that we brought, that have been in exile here, these slaves, they're not our kind of people. They don't fit in. We need to get rid of them. And for whatever the reason, the king, maybe he just doesn't care, maybe it's not that important to him, these are just basically slaves anyway, he agrees to this plan. And the law is made, and then to approve the law, the king takes his ring, and he dips it in wax, and then he pushes it on the piece of paper where that law is printed. And when he pushes that wax seal on it, it makes it the law of the Medes and the Persians. You've probably heard that term before. And the significance of the law of the Medes and the Persians, once that wax seal goes on there, it can never be changed. Even the king cannot revoke the law. So the law goes into effect. And the law states, this is what Haman, just a vicious mind, cruel, is that on the 13th of Adar, which would be the equivalent to our March or February, the 13th of Adar, which is 11 months away, this genocide will take place. How cruel is that? 11 months these people have to wait. Think about the parents. For 11 months, you're trying to figure out how to save your children. How can you get them out of the country? How can you smuggle them out? How can you get yourself out? Because this day is coming. Haman knew exactly what he was doing. It was just this cruel, vicious act. Verse 13 of chapter 3 tells us about it. Dispatchers were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Young, old, women, and children on a single day, the 13th of the 12th month, the month of Adar. Well, Mordecai hears about this. Remember, he's our ace in the hole. He's Esther's cousin. He hears what's going on, so he sends word to Esther, who's in the palace. And he basically says to her, Esther, you are our only chance. You have got the ear of the king. We need you. You're the only one that can talk to the king on our behalf. You got to do something. You have to do something. So Esther sends a message back. Mordecai, you don't understand. There's a protocol here. I can't just walk in anytime I want and talk to the king. He has to ask me. He has to summon me. He hasn't asked me to come in 30 days. If I go, it's a sign of disrespect without him asking, and I can be killed. This is what Mordecai responds with in verse 13 of chapter 4. He says, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time. For such a time as this. You know what he's saying? Esther, do you not realize that maybe the reason that you've gone from being an orphan to the top lady in the kingdom is because God is orchestrating this? This is not just an accident. This is not just so that you can have a life of luxury. Esther, God has put you here for a reason. We need you. We need you to step up to the plate. She needs to make a decision. You know, we've all been there. We've all had those times when we need to step up to the plate for God. Maybe your college professor laughs at you because you believe creation. And you have to step up to the plate and stand up for your beliefs. Or maybe your boss asks you to do something unethical for the finances of the company, and it requires you to step up and say, I'm not going to do that. I can't do that. It's just not right. Or maybe your business associate listens to your marital problems and then on a business trip begins to flirt with you more than normal. Or maybe coworkers mock your morality and they make fun of you because you believe in the biblical model and standard of one man and one woman. And you have to take a stand for your beliefs. Or maybe kids make fun of you at school because you refuse to vape. You don't care what everybody else is doing. You're not going to do it. Or maybe something a little more simple. Maybe it's just getting up in the morning. Because you promised yourself and God that you're going to read his word every day and pray every day, and you got to get up a little earlier. And that alarm goes off, and now you got to make that decision. Am I going to hit the snooze and sleep a little bit more? Or am I going to get up so I can have some time in God's word today? It was time for Esther to make a decision, to step up to the plate. Esther, you're not here just to be comfortable. You don't have all those people waiting on you. You don't have all those perfumes and luxuries. You're not the most desirable and attractive woman in the kingdom just because it was an accident. Esther, you've been brought here by God, and we need you to step up. So she's faced with a decision. She makes the right decision, but she says, you know what, Mordecai? I can't do this by myself. I need you and I need God. And I need you guys to fast and to pray. And it tells us in verse 16, this is the message that she sends back to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa. and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. If I perish, I perish. So the people pray, the people fast. Finally, she goes before the king, we're told. And apparently she goes to the doorway or whatever, because we're told it's kind of like her and the king lock eyes. He holds his scepter out to her, which is his way of saying, come on in, it's okay, even though she wasn't summoned. Come on in. In fact, this is what the king says to her. He says, what is your request? Up to half my kingdom I will give to you. You know, that's the same thing that I say to my wife, Renee, when she comes to my office unannounced. Up to half of my vast estate, I'll give you. You know that black minivan I drive, 2005 with 260,000 miles on it? Renee, half of that is yours. But that's what he tells her. I'll give you half. And she just makes this simple request. She says, here's what I want, Kenny. First of all, I just want us to have a meal together, a little banquet. Just you and I and Haman. And I'll let you know what I want after that. The king's like, okay, sure. So they set up this little banquet thing with just her and Haman and the king. And that night, for whatever the reason, Esther wasn't comfortable. The timing wasn't right. She knew it. And when you read what happens later that night, you understand that she was listening to God's voice. So they have that banquet, and the king says, well, what is it you want? And she knows the timing's not right. She just says, well, I tell you what, let's have another banquet tomorrow night. Just the three of us again. Just us. And so the king says, sure, we'll have another one. And so Haman, he goes home that night, and he is thrilled. I mean, he thinks his life is great. He's hobnobbing with the king and queen. Not one, but two exclusive meals with the king and the queen. And he knows that pretty soon he's going to get rid of that guy Mordecai. In fact, he's even planning that day. On his way home after the banquet, he tells some of his attendants. He said, look, tomorrow I'm going to tell the king about Mordecai, and I'm going to get rid of him. He said, I want you to build some gallows that are 75 foot tall to hang Mordecai on. Remember a few weeks ago when I showed you that picture of the Wilder Tower to tell you about how tall Nebuchadnezzar's statue was? The Wilder Tower is 90 feet, so you're talking gallows that are almost that tall. And he's going to hang Mordecai on? I mean, he comes in, he tells his wife, I'm hobnobbing with the king and the queen. How wonderful is my life? And he goes to bed with a smile on his face, thinking tomorrow he's finally going to get rid of Mordecai. Meanwhile, back at the palace, the king can't sleep. What do you do when you can't sleep? He's got insomnia. He counts sheep, read a book, watch TV, take Tylenol PM, listen to one of my sermons on podcast. Raise your hands if you do that and go to sleep. My wife, she gets up and bakes. That's what she does when she can't sleep. I wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and I'll smell cakes or something baking. That's how she gets sleepy when she has trouble sleeping. Well, the king decides he's going to bring in some minutes or some history chronicles, so to speak, and have them read to him. Now, if you've ever been in a board meeting, you know how boring minutes can be, right? I mean, minutes from a board meeting, that's like Tylenol PM and sermons put together. That's how bad it is. And so they start reading these minutes, hoping it'll put the king to sleep. That's the plan. And his attendant's reading them, and he reads that insignificant story at the end of chapter 2 about this guy named Mordecai who blew the whistle on those two guys that were going to assassinate the king. And the king's like, wait, what did you say? Well, there was this guy, Mordecai, blah, blah, blah. Well, did we ever honor him? No, king, we never did anything for him. Well, we need to do something for that man. I mean, he basically saved my life. And so The next day, Haman comes in. He's had a good night's sleep. He's living this wonderful life. He's going to get rid of Mordecai today. And the king's happy to see him. And he says, Haman, I got a question for you. I need some advice. He said, the king says to Haman, what would you do to honor someone who has done something special for the king? Well, Haman, of course, thinks he's talking about him. And so here's Haman's answer in verse chapter 6, verse 7. Haman's talking. He says, so he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them, through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. And as he finishes it, the king looks at him and he goes, that's a great idea, Haman. I want you to do that for Mordecai. Does God have a great sense of humor or what? Of course, Haman wants to drop through the floor. His hated enemy, he's going to have to put on a horse with the king's robe and go through the streets telling everybody what a wonderful man that Mordecai is. And that's exactly what he does. How humiliating. At some point, he must have went home, got changed, and came back to the banquet that night. And he's still in his mind thinking, tonight I'm going to ask the king to get rid of Mordecai. This is the night. So Haman's there. Esther's there. King Xerxes there. They're all present. The stage is set. And we read in chapter 7, verse 3, Esther steps up to the plate. This young lady steps up. If I have found favor with you, your majesty, and it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Now, for some reason, the king must not remember signing that law, and it probably wasn't a big deal to him at that particular time. The Jewish people were of no importance to him. So he obviously doesn't seem to know what's going on, but he's very disturbed by it. He all at once realizes that Esther is a Jew. And so he asks her, he's upset. He says, who's doing this? And she looks across the table and she goes, the vile Haman. And then we read in verse 7, the king got up in a rage, left his wine. It's interesting the details that scriptures give to us sometimes. What's the significance of him leaving his wine? I don't know, but it's just the detail that scripture sometimes gives. And went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Verse 8, just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she is in with me in the house? As soon as the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. So the king's enraged and he leaves. Well, Haman knows the only chance that he has to save his life is to beg for mercy from Queen Esther. So apparently he's walking toward her and he trips, probably over a Persian rug, I guess, and lands in her lap. And just as he's kind of laying on top of her, guess who walks back in? The king. And of course his mind goes all kinds of places. And he immediately orders that a veil be put over his face. You know what the significance of that is? Once they put that veil over his face, you're a goner. Haman, you're dead. You are a dead man walking at this point. It's curtain, so to speak, for him. His life is over. You'd almost like to have been a fly on the wall in that palace banquet room at that time. Because apparently one of the attendants said something along these lines. Hey, King, by the way, Haman had these gallows built for Mordecai. It doesn't look like we'll be needing them for him. But it'd be a shame to leave those things unused. And so they hang Haman on the gallows that he built for Mordecai. An unbelievable change of circumstances. Unless you know the author. Here's how the story ends. Remember the law of the Medes and the Persians that are supposed to be exterminated on the 13th of Adar? That law can't be changed. But what the king does, he tells the Jews that they can defend themselves. And so when the 13th of Adar rolls around, scriptures tell us that almost 75,000 Persians were killed as the Jewish people defended themselves. And do you know, even today, the Hebrew people still celebrate what happened in the book of Esther? They do it on the 13th of March. It's called the Feast of Purim. And that word Purim actually comes from the word pur, P-U-R. And pur, at its root level of the word, means to roll the dice. Isn't that fascinating? And so what happens, they have a big feast, and then the names of some of the main characters are read. And so whenever they read Haman's name, everybody boos. So let's just kind of practice that this morning. Haman. Boo. Oh, did a good job. And then when they read the name Mordecai. Yay. So the question. What does this ancient story have to do with us today? Two things. First, it reminds us that God is in control. Do you know God's name is never mentioned in the book of Esther, yet his handprints are all over the book? He orchestrated everything. You know, sometimes in that, we've been talking about the upper story and the lower story, that lower story where we all live, that 6-foot horizontal view that we all have, where we're living life and jobs and school and all that kind of, you know, just life. Sometimes it seems like God's not there. God's abandoned us. We can't figure out what God's doing. But in that upper story where God is and where God can see everything and God knows everything, he's still in control. He doesn't ever abandon us. We don't always understand it. We don't always see it. But he is still in control. He knows everything. And the second thing is this. This is a story of courage. Easy would it have been for Esther to say, Mordecai, this is not my problem. It's your problem. You figure it out. I'm in the palace. I'm comfortable. I'm taken care of. I've got a pretty good life here. Don't mess it up for me. Who could blame her, right? But in this story of courage, even though it might cost her life to go before the king and then to make this plea, she did it. Now I hope that none of us in this room ever have to come make a life or death decision regarding our faith. I hope none of us ever have to make that kind of choice. But you know what we do have to do? A lot. We have to make decisions that take courage when we are ridiculed for our faith. Co-workers are other students make fun of you because you pray over lunch. Are you going to take a stand? Or are you going to cave in? People at school might call you a Bible thumper if you get out your Bible or you open up your phone to read scripture while you're at school, lunch, whatever. Some of you probably have families that ridicule you for coming to church every weekend that you're in town. They don't see the need. They don't know why you want to do that. You might be called a fanatic for marching in a right to life rally. Other parents may not like it when you attend a school board meeting and you very politely voice your concern that you would like to see the case for intelligent design taught in our curriculum as well as evolution. Somebody may not like that. You might find yourself in the editorials of the Catoosa County News if you take a stand like that. Teammates may put you down for not going to a party where you know that drinking is going to be prevalent. It takes courage to say, no, I'm not going. It takes courage, like Esther had. Maybe you even have a crazy idea. Maybe you're something like this. Maybe somebody at work, a coworker that you're talking with, and they're struggling with their marriage, and you think to yourself, God just kind of impresses upon you, speaks to you that you just have this idea, well, if I could just sit down with him and her, I just really believe God could use me, and I might help them with their marriage. But then you kind of dismiss that little voice, and you start backing off, and you know, well, I don't really know her that well, and it's really none of my business, etc. And you just back away. I believe that God still speaks to us. He still impresses on us the things that he wants us to do. And he still wants us to do things that are crazy and things that take courage. Imagine how we could change our world if we all had an attitude like Esther had.